everybody. I'm Drew Cook, and you're listening to Gold Microphone, the companion podcast to my blog, Gold Machine. It's been so long since I've done one of these episodes. It'll be 2 years in June. I feel like maybe some introductions are in order, or perhaps we should just kind of level set and talk about where things are with this, and probably the rest of the Drew Cook media empire. That's obviously a joke. Last episode was June of 2022. We had Aaron Reed on, Callie and I. And you may notice Callie's not here. That's reason number one for why it's been so long. I've started this podcast specifically as a thing that Callie and I could do together. And we had a lot of fun doing it. And we were kind of at sort of a magic time in her career where she was working on her dissertation. She had an assistantship, but you know, she was around the house a lot, and we could work on things like this together. And you know, it was really special that we were able to spend so much time with one another. You know, before she graduated and went on to, you know, a full-time job out in the working world. Well, eventually the time demands became too much. She and I both, we had pretty high expectations, high standards for ourselves. And in addition to playing one of these long Infocom games — this podcast is about Infocom games, if you're new — there was all the other prep work, reading reviews, trying to get really comprehensive, exhaustive transcripts that we could refer to, getting together to kind of plan out the episodes and rehearse some of our conversations, identify key points. I mean, it's a lot of work for an hour and a half episode. And it became hard for her to offer up that amount of time, especially since we were beginning to collaborate on game development. I think some of you have probably played my own text adventure game, Repeat the Ending. It's received some nice reviews. It's won some awards. The reaction to it has been incredible. And Callie and I collaborate on that. She did the art for that. And so I think moving forward, since Callie's time is limited, we're going to focus on game development together. We both found that experience very rewarding. And, you know, we're both MFA people. We both experience a lot of joy in creating art, you know. And so as much as we enjoy doing the podcast together, given the, you know, the sad nature of things, there's only so much time. I think we're going to spend it making games together. So Callie's done with the podcast. I mean, she'll be in the audience. I play all this stuff for her before I share it with anybody else. So, and she's still my most trusted advisor when it comes to this or anything else I make. But she won't be putting on headphones and plugging in the mic and doing this with me as a co-creator. And I wasn't sure I wanted to keep going at all. I mean, as I already said, I started this as a thing Callie and I could do together. That was the whole impetus behind Gold Microphone. But, you know, I've heard from a lot of you in the time since that last episode. People asking, Drew, what's going on with the podcast? Are you going to do another podcast? And to me, that's very motivating to hear from people expressing interest, expressing appreciation for things that I've done, you know, that makes me want to do more. And it's as simple as that. So I feel like it's worth a shot trying to do this again. So this is kind of like a reboot. The other reason it motivates me, you know, I enjoy writing at Gold Machine. But it's a very specific type of writing. It's sort of that dry, sort of arch academic formal style that is not for everybody, can be off-putting, especially if I don't seem to like your favorite game as much as you do. You know, I can see how it seems like I'm just really, you know, being negative. But honestly, that's just kind of the style of writing. I'm not trying to be off-putting with that, but I could see how some of you might feel that way. So the podcast is a whole different vibe. For one thing, it doesn't have that carefully laid out argument structure. This is all improvisational. Callie and I didn't have scripts. You know, we had kind of talking points, and then we would discuss things organically. And I kind of want to keep doing that here, because I think that sort of informal improvisation feels a lot more approachable and welcoming to a lot of people. And I enjoy it too. You know, I can kind of loosen up a little bit and just, you know, chase whatever interests me. And hopefully those things will interest you as well. Some of you who've dealt with me online know that sometimes I get distracted or off on funny little tangents. It isn't always easy for me to focus. So I want to apologize in advance if there are less productive digressions. But that's kind of just the way my brain works. And hopefully you'll find it endearing, and there'll be more good than bad coming out of that. Hopefully, you know, sometimes these little sidetracks can be very rewarding. We'll find out, right? You'll have to be the judge of that. Anyway, the point being, that's all part and parcel of kind of a less formal, more organic approach that I think people have really responded to, and that I've found personally rewarding as a creator. So I don't really want to give it up. You know, that's something I've missed as I've been doing Gold Machine, which again is a much more structured, much more dry. And this is kind of where I can just sort of have more personality, which if you like my personality, that'll be good. If you don't, maybe it won't be so good. But this is, we'll just try it and see. We're going to try a reboot, and we're going to see how it goes without Callie. Also, I haven't updated Gold Machine in a while. And if you've been following some of my other projects, you know, I've had kind of a live blogging, a game development thing over at another smaller blog called Top Expert. That hasn't been updated in a while either, after doing, you know, weekly, multiple updates a week. And the reason for that is simple. You know, I'm a disabled person. I don't really lean too heavily into this in my online conversations. And I think a big part of that is my age. You know, when I was growing up, there was such a tremendous stigma associated with mental illness. That there, I felt, and I think, you know, unfortunately, we didn't have the internet where we could talk about, we could meet people like ourselves, you know, and have, you know, any sort of connectedness. It was very isolating and isolated to struggle with mental illness in those days, especially in a small southern town. So as a survival mechanism, you know, I grew up learning to hide that to the best of my ability. And I became very good at it. And it's just ingrained in me not to talk about my disability very much. But you know, I had a pretty severe flare-up of my symptoms over the holidays, and it made it very difficult for me to do anything at all, anything productive. You know, I've said, yeah, there are lots of lots of bad things about my disability, but I think one of the worst things about it is just the sheer amount of time that it's wasted, that I've lost. You know, so there are months of me not doing anything productive when I have all these things I want to do. You know, I want to do my blog, I want to write games, and just to have, you know, 3+ months where nothing happens is very discouraging. You know, that game I was writing about, Top Expert, that was going to be a spring thing entry, and it's not feasible to do that anymore. So I have to regroup and think about when I want to do that. Because, you know, a reality, you can think it's sad, you can think it's great, whatever you think of it. But a reality of contemporary interactive fiction is, unless you're a VIP releasing a game outside the context of a competition or festival, is basically just sending it out to die. It's probably not going to get reviewed by anybody or played by anybody. And so it's not just, oh, what a shame, you know, you can't do spring thing, but you'll just release it some other time. It's like, no, this is a huge loss. It's a huge missed opportunity for me as an author. But this is the kind of thing that happens. And you know, what can you do? I'm feeling better now. That's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm going to be doing some other stuff I'll talk about in a second. But I've wasted so much time over the years, and this is just one case where, you know, you waste time, you miss opportunities, you miss out on things that look really rewarding. And spring thing this year is one of them. So, you know, that's that. And that's why I haven't updated the blog Gold Machine in some time. And hopefully I'll be able to get back to that soon. There have been some other kind of points of apprehension there that are specific to Trinity, the game that is currently the focus at Gold Machine. And will be the focus of this series of podcast episodes. So you're going to get double the Trinity. I was trying to make it up to everybody. But when I shift focus to talk about Trinity, I'll explain some of the misgivings I've had about writing about it, about covering it. But I think that gets you caught up on the delays. We had Callie leave, and then more recently, there have been some health issues that have prevented me from doing really any kind of output. But I'm back. I hope you haven't lost interest in the meantime. I hope I still have some interesting things to say, things that interest you. And if so, I hope you let me know. You know, I'm not really getting paid for this. The main reason I do this is to connect with people. It's human connection. You know, Callie is at work all day. I'm here kind of doing my own thing at home. And it's always wonderful to encounter people who have enjoyed something I've made, whether it's a game, whether it's a blog post, whether it's hopefully one of these podcasts. You know, we'll see what you think. Let's talk a little bit about the format of the podcast going forward. I do think there's an opportunity to maybe change things up. One thing I've become increasingly interested in talking about at Gold Machine and various forums and discords I've visited in the past couple of years is the influence of Infocom as a game designer, as a game developer. There's a tendency, and for those of you who are new, who maybe just don't really know anything about Infocom, you're more a follower of contemporary interactive fiction, hey, that's totally cool, because I think this stuff is still relevant today. Infocom, from a narrative design perspective, is really, I think, Infocom is the first place where we see sort of rich narrative design in a interactive medium. Now, that isn't to say there hasn't been narrative design previously. There are lots of late 70s RPG games that were on, you know, mainframe type computers, Play-Doh educational mini computers. You know, there was lots of stuff out there that could be said to have a narrative. Now, the amount of narrative there was very limited. It usually was just, you want to get this treasure and kill this bad villain monster thing. Now, that's a lot compared to Space Invaders, right? Or Pong. It's certainly a lot compared to Pong. But yeah, there wasn't in a lot of those games much in terms of world development, world building, or character, or you know, kind of descriptive text. And believe me, I'm not just wholesale dismissing every single RPG effort. I'm certainly not dismissing Crowder and Wood's adventure. I know a lot of you are big fans of that. It isn't a big focus for me, and I'll briefly say why in a second. But anyway, if you're new and you haven't really played some of these old Infocom games, I think the important thing is that from a cultural reach perspective, Infocom, you know, not these mainframe RPGs, and not even Crowder and Woods, but Infocom, from a cultural reach perspective, because of its coverage in mainstream media like the New York Times, because of their incredible sales figures, Infocom is ultimately what had the big cultural footprint and reached people who weren't necessarily accessing corporate mainframes or, you know, large computers at educational institutions. You know, these were people who, as part of the home microcomputer boom, you know, buying things like the Commodore 64, which was massively successful in the United States. You know, these were people playing these games in their homes who historically probably had no access to computers. You know, I mean, the first computer I spent any significant, you know, really encountered at all was Commodore 64. You know, that was the first computer I actually used, sat down and typed things at. And I wasn't unique in that. So those games, my thesis has always been that they have a massive influence. And, you know, I'm kind of an outlier in that regard. I think a lot of people get so hung up on the interface of those games. And the interface is not super probably influential in terms of commercial game development today. The interface in those Infocom games like Crowder and Woods Adventure is kind of text in, text out. The game will print descriptive text describing actions, describing a setting, describing objects, and the player will type in commands, simple kind of verb noun commands that act upon the world and its contents. And then the game in turn will print responses to those actions. So that is not a common interface for contemporary commercial games. And I think a lot of people look at those interfaces and just say, oh, what a historical curiosity these games are. What a fascinating dead end in the evolution of interactive media. And increasingly, I've tried to push back. I want to push back because while analyzing interfaces is an important part of understanding the text of a game, it's not all there is. And I think sometimes it's what captures our attention because it's visible. It's the way the player engages with the media. And so you can't really separate the interface from the play experience. But I don't really want to talk about Infocom exclusively from a play experience. I also want to talk about design choices, design tropes, tactics, strategies that those Infocom authors used that, despite changes and evolution in game interfaces, game presentation, audio and visual capabilities, despite everything that's changed in the past 40 years, I think some of these more conceptual design features can really be easily linked between those early 1980s games and games that enjoy critical success and commercial success today. So, first of all, let's talk about how interface can affect narrative. Because it is understandable why a critic would focus exclusively on, have exclusively an interface focused interpretation of a game. So you look at something like Sony's The Last of Us series, and a lot of the animations when doing, stealth takedowns, killing enemies when they are not aware of the protagonist or the player's avatar. Some of them really focus in on the facial expressions of these enemies as they're being choked out or strangled or stabbed. And that's a very brutal, sort of visceral thing to be presented with as a player. And that all goes hand in hand with the interface being a third person action adventure or third person shooter interface. And that brutality is part of the world. It's part of how we're supposed to process the events of that game, those games. And it really wouldn't work if we were playing, say, a point and click adventure game, or if we were playing an isometric sort of top-down game like Hades or the old Baldur's Gate games, it wouldn't have the same effect. The third person perspective is integral to what I consider the game's themes. You got to have that interface for the developers to realize their narrative vision. So that's a way in which interface is crucial to the experience. But now let's think about a way that maybe we can abstract design decisions from interface. And the game I always like to look at for this is Infocom's Deadline, a 1982 game by Mark Blank. It was a mystery game, specifically kind of a police procedural. I mean, you as a player are a homicide detective doing homicide detective stuff. You know, you're searching for clues, you're sending evidence to the forensic lab, you're kind of hassling witnesses in the style of NBC's Columbo to get them to change their story or kind of crack under the pressure. And a lot of attention for both reviewers at the time as well as more contemporary reviewers has been on the kind of clockwork simulation nature of the world. And lots of reviewers of contemporary interactive fiction, you know, not just myself, I've said this, but probably more visibly, Jimmy Marr is kind of the Infocom critic of record. Lots of people, we've all said that kind of simulation, moment-to-moment simulation, that kind of clock ticking where you have, you know, you can have missed opportunities, for instance, hasn't really persisted as a big thing in interactive fiction games, despite making such a big splash at the time. And they're right. You know, you will not see a lot of deadline style simulation in contemporary interactive fiction parser games or otherwise. But what's interesting about that is you do see it in all kinds of other games with different interfaces. You know, I've been playing a lot of Elden Ring, and I'll talk about why that is and why that's germane to this conversation in a bit. But I've been playing a lot of Elden Ring, which is a From Software action RPG. And, you know, there's a day and night cycle in Elden Ring, and different things happen depending on the time of day it is. In addition to just the visual representation of the world changes, depending on what time of day it is. You know, in the old Sierra Quest for Glory series, those point-and-click games, with role-playing elements by Corey and Laurie Cole. You know, they had a day and night cycle with, again, different things happening at different times of day. So, yeah, it doesn't really happen in parser games anymore, but it happens pretty much everywhere else. And you could say, well, that's just coincidence, but, you know, I think... You know, I challenge you to think about it differently. You know, Deadline received extensive mass mainstream media coverage in a time where video games only really turned up in enthusiast magazines. So for New York Times, in an era when newspapers were still... Did you hear that? So... I've said this in previous podcasts, but you know, we have cats, and you know, they're out here living their lives. I don't put them in a closet or something while I do the podcast. So sometimes we'll make a noise or butt up against the microphone or play with the toy or even walk on the keyboard. So I apologize in advance, but that's just the way it is, because I'm not going to make any effort to control the cats. They live here the same way I do, and sometimes they assert themselves, even if I'm recording a podcast. So this is one of those times, and we just had a big kind of cat fuss. I'm not sure if it came across on the mic or not, but if it did, that's what it was. But anyway, this kind of simulation has turned up all over the place. And you can't really say, oh, well, people don't play text adventure games anymore, so it has no influence, because that's not really, I mean, maybe there's a place or a scenario where influence works that way, where it's strictly, you know, you have a parent, and either your parent, you know, was a text adventure game or it wasn't. But that's not really how things operate in culture. As an example, you know, you don't have to read Hamlet or read Macbeth or watch them performed to experience media that has been influenced by Hamlet or Macbeth, right? Because they're pervasive. They're part of the cultural fabric of storytelling, not just in the West, really. You know, I mean, you see things like Macbeth turn up all over the place. The Three Witches, for instance, which are archetypal. Point being, video games are the same way, okay? So somebody making a game in 2024, they don't need to have played Deadline to be influenced by Deadline. When you have the newspaper of record writing a glowing review of a game, you know, that's something that has reach. That's something that goes above and beyond just basic, hey, I played this game and decided to make a game. That's something that is just kind of seeping into the cultural fabric. And in fact, what Infocom did with Deadline, from that kind of clockwork world, that event-driven world, is everywhere. It's all over the place. And just because you don't see it in the kind of pro-am enthusiast IF scene doesn't mean that it didn't take off, because it really did. And the other example from Deadline is the idea of the reactive world. You know, there's a lot of reactivity in the world of Deadline. You know, if you show a piece of evidence to somebody, they'll start saying different things, or they'll perform different behaviors. You know, so the world changes based on the player's actions in the world. Now, that is super common. Again, you already talked about the Quest for Glory games. That's a early example of that happening, but really, I mentioned Elden Ring. It happens in Elden Ring all over the place. You kill a boss and different people will say different things about it. And again, it isn't, I'm not saying that Miyazaki was playing, played Deadline and then sat down to make Elden Ring. That's not the way these things work. But somebody had to make the first complex reactive world, you know. And that needed to be an idea that took root in the world of video games. And the place where that happened was Deadline. And it really isn't possible to say, make a game as if Deadline never existed. I mean, you could say that, but it'd be silly. It'd be like saying, write, you know, a play as if Hamlet never existed, you know, because you can't, because it does exist. And a lot of people have responded to it over the years. And it's more like a cloud than it is like a lineage, all right? So to me, again, I push back, because I think these Infocom games have had a profound influence on narrative game design. And I want people to recognize that. You know, these games are important to me. I see a lot of value in them. And I think we do them a disservice by just saying, boy, isn't it interesting? Isn't it kind of quaint the way these 80s people with their, cute little microcomputers used to play games where they type things. I mean, yes, that is interesting, and turns out they're fun if you try them, but it's also completely misunderstanding what influence is and what the contribution of Infocom has been to the world of gaming. It's been massive. And so I want to push back at that. And I think part of me wanting to do that is that I need to show my work, so to speak. And I feel like in order to avoid just kind of talking through what I like about these games or what I find is interesting about these games, because, that's worthwhile. And to an extent, I do a lot of that from that, again, that kind of dry academic perspective at Gold Machine. But if I want to go further and really talk about influence, then I'm going to have to show my work. I'm going to have to bring more newer games, games that follow Infocom, into this conversation and start looking at, okay, what are some design features here that we also see over here? Or what are some ways in which this design struggles, and narrative games continue to struggle in this way even today? How can I basically set some games up in conversation with each other and try to see what significant contributions can Infocom make to these discussions? How can they enrich our understanding of what's happening in more modern game design? Because I think it's there. I don't think that's actually a very hard case to make, but I probably need to go a step further and not just say, oh, well, this is how it is and everybody should see it. And I should probably at a more fundamental level say, okay, game X and game Y. And here's the lines I'm drawing. So with that in mind, I think the direction for the podcast is really to start those conversations. I'm supposed to be working on Trinity at Gold Machine, and I promise to say what some of the challenges are for me, why I've kind of resisted going forward with that. But more important, I'd like to show how it's how it can be still experienced as fresh, as kind of a vibrant participant in the contemporary fabric of games, which I think it can be. Now, this idea came to me while I was playing another game, Trinity. Of course, if you followed Infocom, if you're a fan, if you've been following my work, you probably already know that Trinity is one of Infocom's best-loved games. It's very well-regarded critically. It's had this kind of glowing treatment from Jimmy Marr. Again, it's kind of the Infocom guy of record, in which I can't remember how many parts that series is. It's pretty massive, and it basically kind of asserts that because of the historical nature of its subject matter, that Trinity is kind of a transcendent work, which, as a player, I don't completely agree with, but I think a lot of people do agree with Mar. So I'm not saying that's silly or stupid. Doesn't really ring true for me, but a lot of his series is about the Manhattan Project and not really about playing the game. But I think for a lot of players, being able to link that sort of historical content with the content in Trinity is very meaningful and rewarding for them. That's all to say, I, as somebody who hasn't really felt as connected with that perspective, hasn't really felt as satisfied with that kind of response, I've been hesitant to write a lot about Trendy because I don't want to alienate my readers, you know, or make them feel that I think their favorite game isn't very good. You know, I have a lot of respect for Brian Moriarty and for Trendy. You know, I think Sentence to Sentence, there are two, Infocom has two games that kind of vie for the spot of best craft writing. As a reminder, you know, I'm an MFA. I've taught, you know, a small amount as part of assistantship, writing at the college level, both creative and academic writing. So, you know, whether you agree with my opinion about craft writing, I at least have worked hard to have an opinion that's based on experience and study. And it is my opinion, take it, like it or not, that there are two games that compete for best writing in an Infocom game, and those are Brian Moriarty's Trendy and Dave Lebling's Spellbreaker. Now, personally, I'm more of a Spellbreaker person, and I think that's big part of that is my training as a poet. So I really value the concision that's required because of the severe space constraints that Lebling had writing Spellbreaker for very limited systems like the Commodore 64. Moriarty had a chance to be more expansive in Trendy because it had double the game file size possible. And I think a lot of the times that I really value that kind of the forced, there's something poetic about a certain kind of compressed writing that I think Lebling achieves. I think there's a lot of poetry in Spellbreaker, and I just admire a lot. But again, Moriarty's right there, and a lot of people will prefer the writing in Trendy over the writing in Spellbreaker, and that's really going to be down to personal taste. Like, I wouldn't set out to make an objective argument that one's better than the other. I think these are just both terrifically written games, and some people are going to like one more than the other. And that, you know, that's fine. So I have a lot of respect for the writing in Trendy. I think a lot of the puzzles in Trendy are fantastic. And I don't want to steal my own thunder, so I'll talk about that in a future episode. But what I want you to take from all this is that I hold Trendy in very high regard, whether or not I like it as much as you do. I hold it in very high regard, and I didn't want to be misunderstood, and I didn't want people to get upset. Believe it or not, people do get upset with some of the things I say. I mean, maybe it's very believable. I don't know. But they do. I get sometimes some pretty nasty or negative messages from people in response to content at Gold Machine. Now, I don't publish those messages or quote them or talk about them on the podcast. You know, I never say, hey, look at this person being kind of mean to me, really just because I don't want that kind of negativity as part of this brand. You know, I don't want flame wars to kind of define what I do. This is something I do to connect with people, not something I do to contend with others over, you know. So when things like this happen, I just kind of set aside and move on. But that doesn't mean I like it, you know, or that it makes me feel good. And so I haven't really wanted to I haven't wanted to upset people by being critical of Trendy, and that's been hard for me to do. You know, I've wondered, well, Should I just kind of water things down and just not talk about not give an honest assessment as I see it, or should I really just kind of say forget it, I don't care, I'm gonna keep going? And the result's sort of been that I just haven't done anything over Trinity. You know, I haven't done an update in a while, and I've been apprehensive about it. But there's kind of a breakthrough while I was playing a completely unrelated game. See, now we're coming back to the episode, right? A completely unrelated game, Vampire the Masquerade Swan Song, which, unlike Trinity, is not, nobody's that I know of saying this is a great game. It's a pretty underwhelming game, a disappointing game. It had severe issues. I played it because I'm interested in the setting, the World of Darkness setting, and that'll also be covered more in the next episode. But point is, I played this game through to completion, and I found it very disappointing and sometimes exasperating. And I realized while I was playing it, one of the things that bothered me in Vampire the Masquerade Swan Song is something that kind of happens in Trinity. Now, because we have such a vast gulf in terms of quality between Trinity and Swan Song, it's not like I'm saying, oh, Trinity's just like Swan Song. It's not. But I think talking about this issue in both games is illuminating. And I think reveals how some challenges in game design really haven't changed from the 1980s to now. Okay. And that's something I've wanted to hammer home. So, believe it or not, we're going to start talking about Trinity here by talking about Vampire the Masquerade Swan Song, which is really kind of a successor to the point-and-click games of the 90s. The interface will be very familiar to people who played those types of games. And so I think there's a lot of overlap there with the current interactive fiction community and people who played Sierra games. I already mentioned the Quest for Glory games, and that's going to be kind of my central touchstone for looking at the structure of Vampire the Masquerade Swan Song. But I think we can put these together and have a really interesting discussion. And that sort of led me to believe playing that game is like, oh, well, this is a way I can talk about Trinity. You know, this is an entry point for me. This is a way to make this fresh. And that really excited me. And I hope it interests you too. We're gonna talk about that. We're gonna talk about a Graham Nelson essay, Craft of the Adventure, which is kind of a seminal piece of craft writing about interactive fiction. Although, just like I think we can think more broadly about design and interactive fiction, I think we can look at Nelson's writing more broadly and think about how it applies to the wider world of video games today, narrative games today. So I think there's going to be a lot of fun stuff that we can kind of poke at and look at and analyze as we go through this series, which I envision as multiple 1 hour episodes. Speaking of which, we're kind of right at 1 hour now, and I should wrap things up. I'll be doing an update at Top Expert to try to explain what's going on with the game, and I'll also do an update soon at Gold Machine for similar reasons. Hopefully, those of you who just like my stuff will check those out as well. Also, I'm not ready to announce anything yet, but I'm considering doing some gameplay videos for more kind of mainstream commercial games. More on that soon. I hope some of you will gravitate toward that, even if that's not really your wheelhouse. Anyway, like I said, I'm starting to feel better, and that means there's a lot to do and a lot going on, and I'm finally looking forward to things. So hopefully you only have like a week or so to wait for the next episode. I'd like to just keep this thing moving. Get in touch. Let me know what you think about the plan. Hopefully it sounds interesting to you. I think we can have a lot of fun with it. Again, I'll have links in the show notes for Nelson, for Vampire the Masquerade Swan Song, for some content on Trinity. so that if you want to kind of follow along with what I'm looking at and thinking of, you'll have the resources there for you to look at. And that's it, guys. I hopefully will be talking to you in another week or so. I hope you enjoyed the return. Thanks for being so patient. Bye now.